this loaded. All right. So how many of you all in the room are lawyers? Okay, we have a few. All right, well, that's good. It's good that there's only a few of you, because some of the stuff is going to be seem like some basic civic stuff, but it's important for us to be speaking from the same sheet of music, and I was asked to at least provide this primer before launching into the tools and things that we're working on. All right, so it's important for me to let you know that I have no relationships to disclose from a personal financial relationship perspective. And our agenda. We're going to go a little out of order here. It's going to be me speaking first, then we'll hear from Tara, then we'll hear from Maris Ash, then we will hear from Donna Levin, and then finally, or lastly, we'll hear from Jennifer Pomeranz. All right, so for my mini course, I'm going to try to answer three basic questions. Why public health law? What is public health law? And to talk to you a little bit about the four major sources of public health authority, so the major sources of law and their impact on public health authority. From the CDC's public health law program perspective, public health law is important because it's the foundation for the practice of public health in the United States. The way I like to say it is there is no public health without the law. You think about establishing a health department, the mission of a health department, appropriating funds for a health department. Law serves as the foundation for governmental public health practice in this country. As we'll learn from our panelists as they talk about the different areas of law that they're working on, law is also an effective public health intervention. Those of you who have seen Tom Frieden speak or heard him speak, this is one of his favorite slides, and I've stolen it because if you look where the blue arrow is pointing, he points out that socioeconomic factors are the most significant factors that affect health. But right above that, or right next to that, is changing the context, and that's where public health law comes into play, or where law comes into play. We have examples listed there like fluoridation, using law as a tool to ensure that our water is fluoridated to advance oral health. Trans fats, smoke-free laws, tobacco taxes, all of those are examples of how law is used to influence health outcomes. And again, it changes the context. We'll see a quote moving forward from Michael Bloomberg that furthers underscores that. Right here. He says, in the realm of public health, it's the law that really does the work. It's been demonstrated time and time again in areas ranging from mandating vaccinations to requiring automobile seat belts, improving workplace safety, inspections of meat products, and fluoridation of water. Public health succeeds by making healthy choices the norm. So what is public health law? According to Larry Gostin, who is a scholar in public health law, he defines it as the legal powers and duties of the state to assure the conditions for people to be healthy, but it's also the limitations on that power to constrain the autonomy, privacy, liberty, proprietary, and other legally protected interests of individuals for the protection or promotion of community health. So there's a balancing act there. We have a duty, but there are also limitations on that power, and that we have to ensure that we're not unreasonably or unnecessarily infringing on civil liberties. And I recently heard Polly Price, who is a professor at professor of law at Emory University School of Law, define public health law as policy enacted through the democratic process. And I liked that definition because if we think about it, the people that we elect to office certainly have a significant role in determining health outcomes because they are the ones that introduce and pass and sometimes do not pass laws. And so I kind of really like this definition. Public health law, from the public health law program's perspective, is not just limited to laws related to the health department. The work that we do, as you'll hear Tara talk about, looks at the role of just about any law that has a significant consequence on the population. So it's things that we're beginning to like zoning, which we recognize as clearly the built environment, it impacts the population's health. But a lot of folks don't necessarily look at zoning laws as public health laws. I think more of us are coming into that, but that's an example. So it's any law that impacts the health of the population. It's laws that alter the environment, creating biking paths, creating access to healthier foods and healthier fruits and vegetables, healthier foods. Laws that alter the environment in which we have to wear helmets when we cycle to prevent injuries. Law also helps alter the informational environment. So we have here a woman here who's buying some spaghetti sauce, and she's reading the ingredients and making, we hope, healthier choices based upon the ingredient lists there. And law also penalizes risky behavior. So there are fines for not wearing seatbelts, fines for polluting environments, fines for littering, and those sorts of examples. All right, so I'm going to wrap up my presentation by touching on the major sources of public health authority. First, we have constitutions, federal and state constitutions. We have statutes, federal statutes, state statutes, and local ordinances. We also have regulations on the federal and state level. And we have case law. And those of you who are public health lawyers in the room or public health practitioners have probably heard the Jacobson case. If you haven't, if you learn nothing else today, you'll learn a little bit about the Jacobson case, which we consider to be the seminal case in public health or public health law. All right, so I'm going to talk to you a little bit about the Constitution framework for public health practice. We know that the U.S. Constitution is the supreme law of the land. What's important for our purposes here today are that it confers a very limited set of enumerated powers to the federal government. The federal government, our actions are limited to those related to interstate commerce, national defense, and third one is slipping my mind, and taxing and spending, which is going to come up again in taxing and spending. So everything else is left to the states for and we call those police powers. The 10th Amendment frames those powers, and it says those powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution nor prohibited to it by the states are reserved to the states respectively or to the people. So the impact of our constitutional framework on public health practice is that states retain police powers and other powers not expressly enumerated to the U.S. federal government. It is the states that have the extraordinary power to protect the public's health, the health of the population within their boundaries. Public health, again, is not mentioned in the national or the federal constitution. We do some federal public health-related activities under the power to regulate interstate commerce, under the power to tax and spend. Other federal government functions in public health are carried out through regulatory agencies, including the FDA, EPA, and some through non-regulatory agencies like CDC, whereas we provide guidance. There are a few instances where CDC has regulatory authority, but generally we are a non-regulatory agency. And we also, in the federal government, shape state and local public health through funding and defunding through our appropriations process. So really quickly, statutes and ordinances have several functions listed here. They express the intent of the legislative branch. A statute will create and empower an executive agency. Statutes also provide for the regulation of various activities, provide agencies authority to promulgate regulations and oversee regulated activities. We also see statutes that appropriate money, as mentioned, and statutes that make certain activities a crime. We're going to see some examples of public health statutes here. We have an example of the Public Health Service Act, Section 311, and it reads, the Secretary is authorized to accept from state and local authorities any assistance in the enforcement of quarantine regulations. And this is particularly important because with our system of federalism and police powers, where the states have most of the power or the power to act, we've got to be asked, or it's got to be written in statute before we infringe on what's happening in states, particularly in a public health emergency. We have another example here. This is a state statute. I live in Georgia, so we use some examples from the state of Georgia. This is an example of what I like to call the foundational law, or how law is used as a foundational tool, because it establishes the public health agency here. It says the Department of Public Health shall safeguard and promote the health of the people of this state and is empowered to employ all legal means appropriate to that end. It also empowers the state health department. The Department of Public Health is empowered to, for example, provide epidemiological investigations and laboratory facilities and services in the detection and control of disease. The third source of public health authority that I want to mention are regulations, which are basically agency-made rules, so rules made by the executive agency. And the goal here is to describe the substance and the process for carrying out the language that's written in statute, if that makes sense. So, for example, there may be a statute that requires that certain diseases be reported by healthcare providers. What you'll see in statute is substantive language that describes a list of conditions to be reported. And also in regulation, you'll see language that talks about the process, the forms, or how you would do that disease reporting. Regulations tend to be more detailed and more technical than statutes, and they tend to be written by the experts in the field. So they kind of know what needs to happen in order to implement what the legislature had in mind in writing a statute. So an example here, the authority to regulate is written in statute in Georgia, and this is related to school immunizations, and it says no child shall be admitted to or attend any school or facility in the state unless the child shall first have submitted a certificate of immunization to the responsible official or to the school or facility. Then it gives the authority to the Department of Public Health, again the experts, to write the rules and regulations to carry that out. Department of Public Health shall promulgate rules and regulations specifying those diseases against which immunization is required. And then we see examples of the regulatory language. Immunization against the following named diseases shall be required for entrance into the school, and the list goes on there. And so the last one on my list before we hear from our panelists who talk about current projects, which is what I'm sure you all came here for, to find out what's currently going on in the field. I'm going to talk to you a little bit about case law and the Jacobson case. Case law is made by courts, interpreting the Constitution, interpreting statutes and regulations while ruling on disputes between parties. The rulings or the findings of that court then attach to statutes and regulations and become a part of, as we've seen play out with the Affordable Care Act, and become a part of that statute or regulation. Previous rulings impact current disputes that involve the interpretation of the same statutes or regulations, and we call that precedent. And if case law comes from the same jurisdiction and is from a higher court, the rulings are binding on the lower court. And so let's take a look at the Jacobson case. Who doesn't know the Jacobson case before I? There's a few hands. Yeah, okay, all right. And those who know it, help me out here, all right? So in 1902, City of Cambridge, Massachusetts had a mandatory vaccination law. Reverend Henning Jacobson, pictured here, refused to be vaccinated and was fined $5, which in the early 1900s was quite a bit of money. And he sued. And it made it all the way up to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court in 1905 upheld the Cambridge, Massachusetts mandatory vaccination law, saying there are manifold restraints to which every person is necessarily subject for the common good. And Jacobson is a particularly important case in public health because it did at least three important things. One, it demonstrates the deference that the judicial system pays to public health when we're acting in a reasonable way. It underscored the importance that any activity that public health actors undertake using their public health authority be reasonable, and that there is equal protection under the law for the individuals that are impacted. And it also articulated that states can pass that police power that I talked about earlier down to local health departments and local public health jurisdictions. And so that's it for my quick primer. Please visit our website. Tara's going to talk to you about that. We have a full-length Public Health Law 101 course, which we're hoping to revise over the next year. We do travel and offer Public Health Law 101 for state and local health departments and other partners. So we're here to hopefully this piqued your interest a little bit. And with that, I will turn the mic over to Tara Ramanathan, who's going to talk to you a little bit about public health law program.